Thank you, Dr. Lieberman, for getting things started. I was commenting to him, this is a really big group to hear about pretty mundane topics, except when you start to consider one thing, this is ultimately how you get paid. And certainly you would think then this room should be much bigger and it would be busting at the seams, because as you all showed to us with Dr. Barney's initial question, typically we're saying about 55 to 60% of practicing surgeons are now employed, and RVUs have a huge component or impact on that. So Dr. Lieberman has talked all about the process of developing an RVU and how that's generated. And I'm going to talk a little bit around that. I'm going to talk specifically about scenarios where you're doing something where there isn't an RVU for it. Here are my disclosures, and they won't impact my talk, as you'll find out. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about the CPT process. Dr. Lieberman touched on it a little bit. I'm going to talk a little bit about the process then to generate RVUs and what you can do at your own institution if you perform a procedure where there currently is either not a code or there is not an RVU for the code that represents the procedure you're performing. So I'm going to start off with a little CPT 101, a little bit more about what Dr. Lieberman just spoke about, and then we're going to talk about those methodologies that could be used at your institution to help in these situations. So CPT has been around longer than the RVU, and it started off with initially a four-digit code system. Computers were becoming popular. It was an effective way to track the interactions between physicians and their patients. And over the course of the late 1960s and early 1970s, there were iterations that were developed and expanded. The concepts that were covered were initially surgical, but then they started to involve office visits and less surgical-based interactions between physicians and patients. And ultimately, the code system that we use today is over 40 years old. It was the fourth iteration, published in 1977, and it was adopted as the methodology by which physicians will communicate with payers beginning in the early 1980s, initially with HCFA, now known as CMS. Why is CPT so important? CPT is ultimately that communication system that ends up allowing physicians to represent the work that they're doing with their patients. Now, the AMA controls the CPT. Dr. Lieberman touched on that during his talk. Both the committee that makes recommendations to CMS about RVU values for a particular interaction between patients and physicians, and the code system by which those interactions are signified, are run by the AMA. When you buy a CPT book or your office buys a CPT book, they buy it from the AMA. And you can see it's very helpful for the AMA to make sure that this system is very effective, because it ultimately contributes heavily to their bottom line. Now, it's not separated in their public announcements, but as you can see last year, CPT at least was part of a significant amount of revenue that was generated for that organization. The CPT editorial panel, and as we heard, we have a member here and one of our members on the DS here, Dr. Barney is the general surgeon who currently is on the panel, is represented by 17 members. And there are some of them that are recommended by different organizations, some of them insurance, some of them other healthcare organizations. And ultimately, they discuss this coding system. But every organization that has a seat in the AMA House of Delegates has an opportunity to make a comment about a CPT code that is being discussed by the panel. They also have an opportunity to make a comment during the RUC process that Dr. Lieberman discussed. Now, it wouldn't be appropriate for an ophthalmologist to make a comment about a cystoscopy. So you stay within your area of discipline, But it is possible that a gastroenterology group may make a comment about a gastrointestinal procedure when a CPT code is being developed for it. CPT codes have three different categories. Category one is the one that most people in the room probably are familiar with. So it is a common main procedure, a mainstream procedure that is approved by the FDA, and it is documented very effectively within the literature. An example, many people that perform abdominal surgery would be familiar with, a laparotomy is a Category 1 CPT code. Category 2 CPT codes are not commonly used by physicians to identify their actions with their patients. It's used by usually a hospital to identify some form of measurement or quality signifier, and the example that I've given here, many of us are familiar with the SCIP initiative to initiate DVT prophylaxis within 48 hours of the initial hospital admission. There is a CPT Category 2 code for that. The third code system was initiated or developed to represent interactions between patients and physicians that do not qualify for the Category 1 code. So these are commonly procedures that are new. These are commonly procedures that are innovative. They are not necessarily mainstream procedures. And you can see I gave an example here of one that uses ultrasound to assess bone density. The difference between Category 1 and Category 3 codes is that Category 3 codes are not common enough that the RUC process has been performed for them, so there is no RVU value for a Category 3 code. If they are covered by an insurer or by a payer, they will be there will be a value specifically for that payer for that particular code, and it will be different from one payer to the next, and that's commonly referred to as carrier priced. These codes do not last ad infinitum. They are meant to be short term. The concept is that eventually, if this is so important or if this is so impactful on healthcare, that will eventually become a Category 1 code. Now, many of us are familiar that the CPT code system not only has the 5-digit code for each physician-patient interaction, but there is an opportunity to use 2-digit or 2-alphanumeric code signifiers that will provide more information or provide greater clarity to that particular interaction. So if you are in the operating room and you're performing multiple procedures that are distinct, for example, if you perform a gastric bypass and you perform a cholecystectomy at the same time, you don't get the full RVU value for the gastric bypass added to the full RVU value for the gallbladder, the cholecystectomy. The multi-procedure rule goes into effect, and this is represented by the 51 modifier. You will get 50% of the lesser value RVUs. So in that circumstance, the gallbladder is the lesser value. You will get 50% of the RVUs for that particular procedure. Endoscopy works differently. If you perform a snare of a colonoscopic polyp, but you also perform a biopsy, they will take the integral or the increment between the base procedure, a straightforward screening colonoscopy or therapeutic colonoscopy, and the increment between that and what the snare would be. And they will add that all together. So it is not exactly the same for endoscopy as it is for surgical procedures. There are a lot of modifiers, and some of them have a significant impact on how one can be reimbursed when they are doing procedures. So the ones on the left side of the screen are helpful to identify when you are performing multiple procedures in specific scenarios. It is important, if you do breast surgery, to include laterality to your CPT code because you may get denied by certain payers if you do not provide left or right laterality designation. Now, most of us don't do that. Our coders do it for us behind the scenes in the back office. If you evaluate a patient in the emergency room and you decide that that patient needs to go to the operating room within the next 24 hours, you would use a 57 modifier so that you would get paid for that interaction, that diagnostic service, in addition to the surgical procedure. If you didn't use the 57 modifier, you would still get paid for the surgery, but your visit that evaluated the patient would be considered part of that 24 hours of pre-service that's part of the procedure. So you use the 57 modifier to say, no, this was somebody that I just met, and this is somebody that I am now making a decision to take to the operating room, and we're going within the next 24 hours. On the right side of the screen are scenarios in which you can use a modifier to change the way that you are compensated for your work. So one that many surgeons are familiar with or are interested in becoming familiar with is the top one, the 22 modifier, which increases compensation by 25%. Now, you can imagine if a surgeon's coding system to a payer has 75% of the code submitted to that payer with a 22 modifier, that payer might become suspicious that that surgeon is not being authentic in their description of the work that they're performing. And so, in general, the operative note has to be submitted when a modifier is used, and it needs to clearly suggest that the amount of work that was being done here was being done more than what is typically being done. The typical patient is the 50%, the median patient. And you can see if you use an assistant, that assistant will receive a small amount of the RVUs as well. And if you have two surgeons, the two of them basically split 125% of the RVUs. So what if we have that scenario, transitioning now from CPT 101 to what do we do if there is no CPT code or RVU for what I do? Well, what if there's no code? That's the first step. Well, you can apply for one. It is possible for anyone to apply for a CPT code. It is a process that there is a form that can be obtained from the AMA, and they can fill out the form and submit it for any particular meeting. The meetings have deadlines, and so the whole process can be done individual by a private person. Now, naturally, members of the college would hope that if a fellow was interested in doing that, that they would consult with the members of the college who represent the organization in this environment so that it can be a successful application and that it is consistent with what is currently present or is going to meet all of the requirements to meet a successful end. So if you're going to perform a Category 1 application, as you can see, there are some requirements for it, as I stated. And one of the most difficult components to meet for the application process is obtaining appropriate literature to show that this particular interaction is one that is commonly performed and one that is represented as being a main part of what we do on a daily basis throughout the country, not just in one geographic location, but throughout the country. And so there are requirements for the literature for each scenario in which a new code is being applied. So if a code is successful or if a code is being brought up, I guess there are a couple of different things that can be done. Dr. Lieberman touched on this a little bit. A current code may be revised. It could be referred to a work group, or maybe more information is needed and no decision is made. Sometimes the code is rejected. Sometimes a person who's looking for a Category 1 code, one that is commonly recognized by payer, will receive a Category 3 code because the editorial panel has decided that the procedure has not met the elements to be considered a mainstream procedure. And this is commonly what happens with new surgical procedures. The numbers that are being performed, the literature that is available to support them is not robust. And so the decision is not to give it a Category 1 code, but to give it a Category 3 code, which frequently changes how insurance and providers or payers consider it with regard to coverage. So that has to be part of the decision-making process. And if it is assigned a Category 1 code, then it will go on to the RUC system. And incidentally, if you were to have applied for a code and are going to participate in the CPT meeting this year, it wouldn't show up on the book until 2020. So anything in 2018 will not show up until 2020. So what do we do with codes without RVUs? Well, there are certain examples where there are codes without RVUs, and that is unlisted codes and carrier-priced codes. Unlisted codes are codes that are meant to be catch-all codes. And you will see these in just about every area of the CPT codebook with regard to the certain organ systems of the body. There will be one for the stomach, there will be one for the colon, one for the kidney, and so on. But these don't have an RVU because they are catch-all codes, so they can represent a lot of different procedures. So in the book, they would have a zero RVU value. Carrier price codes are ones where there weren't enough people to survey and receive a value, as Dr. Lieberman touched on. So in this circumstance, if it's covered service, the carrier will provide a payment, but in the book that your coders and billers look at, there would still be a zero RVU value, even though you might get paid for that particular service. So what do you do in these circumstances where you have no RVUs, but you're doing a procedure and you're actually using a code to represent that activity? Well, you need to recognize your organization, and you need to understand that they have certain agendas and you have your own agenda. And so it's helpful, and Dr. Senkowski is going to touch on this, to align yourself and recognize what your procedure and what you're doing, how it interacts with their missions. It's helpful to get information from your coders and billers to understand if this is getting covered, to talk to your colleagues around the country who are doing the procedure and see if they're getting paid for it, to recognize how this procedure would impact patient care. Maybe it leads to a reduced length of stay. And then try to determine if your organization already has a policy by how they address these codes. Many of them do, and many surgeons don't even know what that policy is. So if there isn't a policy, then here is one way you can approach it. So you have to consider the procedure that you're doing, and you have to consider two major components of that procedure. How intense is it? In other words, how hard are you working when you're doing it? And how much time it takes. And time is the most important component with regard to a physician's compensation. Much more than intensity, because I can assure you, intensity is relative. And every physician works very hard, and every physician has really sick patients. So time is the one consistent thing that can't be changed. Perception is perception. Now, surgeons, unfortunately, their perception of time is frequently wrong. Just ask your spouse, ask the charge nurse. We all are wrong about our time perception, but it is a recordable, objective measure. So recognize that component and recognize how that will compare to a procedure that's commonly performed. So for example, we're going to try to figure out how to generate a code for this carrier price or value for this carrier price code. It does not have RVUs. It is carrier priced. Now, one option you could say is, well, I know that this involves making an incision and there's a couple of stitches in the belly, and I'm going to take a code for making the incision in the belly, and I'm going to take a code for putting a couple stitches, and I'm going to add all of those together. We call that a building block methodology. The problem with that is each one of those codes, as Dr. Lieberman has pointed out, has a lot of things baked in there, not just what's going on in the procedure, but there's time prior to that procedure, there's time after the procedure. So this building block methodology, although seems to make common sense, is not the preferred methodology to go about doing this. A much better methodology would be to say, I'm going to compare it to a procedure that's all in one, and seems pretty similar. And we would say that this uses a crosswalk. You're crosswalking over to a procedure that has a value. and you're estimating the overall work, what we call magnitude estimation. And so in this circumstance, maybe a good value for this particular procedure, this open implant implantation of the neurostimulator, would be similar to opening up a person's belly and closing a gastrostomy. Now, if you explain that to your colleagues, they will probably understand, well, that kind of makes sense. Even the most non-procedure-oriented physicians in the group would probably still have an understanding to that. So that works for the carrier price codes because you have a CPT code, your coders can use it, they're going to use the charges for this other one, they're going to submit that, and it's going to make sense, and you get RVUs. Well, what do you do in the circumstance where you have an unlisted code? Here's a code that has a bunch of different potential things. So an unlisted laparoscopic procedure code for stomach could be a partial gastrectomy, it could be a total gastrectomy, it might be a gastric biopsy. There could be at least a half a dozen different codes that could be covered by this unlisted code. So in this circumstance, a good way to go is to generate an internal coding system for your group or for your organization. And then that code can be compared to a current code that's available. So here you're going to do a laparoscopic distal gastrectomy. Compare it to the open distal gastrectomy with a Roux and Y, and you have this internal code, IC123, and you can provide it a work RVU value that is equal to the open one. It makes sense for most administrators. It makes sense for most billers. It'll make sense to your colleagues. So how do you do this all in your organization? Well, first of all, like I said, you have to figure out if there's a policy already, because it might be that the policy is not convenient. It's possible that it exists, but nobody follows it. So I would recommend, and this is what we have done at IU, is gather a multidisciplinary group, because there's going to be people in other disciplines that will have unlisted and carrier price codes. And it's important for everybody to be involved, because you don't want the perception that one group is getting favored status over another. And ultimately, when you work in a multidisciplinary employed group, you frequently have a scenario very similar to CMS where the pie is only so big and it's being divided up and the resources are only so big. So it's helpful to have everybody involved and to have multiple members of different disciplines involved. You should develop a pseudocode system. I think it's very helpful in the unlisted code scenarios. And follow up on the financial data. That's very important to see if there is reimbursement for these procedures. So in conclusion, Category 1 CPT codes are the mainstay by which we communicate with payers and we document what we do. Don't follow other people's mistakes ahead of you and try to bully your way through this process. It's helpful to have a group within your organization that can gather and discuss this, that understand the methodologies that are commonly used, and can be fair and equal to all members of the group and make sure that there's no animosity that's hidden behind it. But it's very important to have constant connection to your coders and your billers to make sure that the system is robust and that it's maintained throughout the organization. Thank you.